Chapter 4. Check the Ego. Jocko Willink. Camp Corregidor, Ramadi, Iraq. Welcome to Ramadi. Enemy tracer rounds were zipping overhead as I raced up the stairs to the third-story rooftop of our Tactical Operations Center, or TOC, building. Our camp was under attack. I hadn't even had time to fasten my body armor. When the shooting started, I grabbed my helmet and rifle, slung my load-bearing equipment over my shoulders, and headed for the roof. SEALs were arriving by the dozen, some in flip-flops with only shorts and t-shirts under their body armor, but helmets on and weapons at the ready. Just across the river, in the darkness, enemy fighters had unleashed heavy volleys of machine gun fire on two separate U.S. outposts, and the American soldiers were returning fire with a vengeance. The bright glow of tracer fire was evident in both directions. Another group of enemy fighters had engaged our camp and were hammering our TOC building with gunfire from the far bank of the Euphrates River. But they hadn't counted on the response. Within minutes, every Navy SEAL in Task Unit Bruiser and several of our non-SEAL support personnel were on the rooftop shooting back. Some SEALs had brought their M4 rifles, other M79 40mm grenade launchers, others their Mark 48 and Mark 46 belt-fed machine guns. We unleashed incredible volleys of fire back at the enemy fighters' muzzle flashes. I directed an M79 gunner to put some 40mm illumination rounds up so we could better identify our targets. Leif was on the rooftop right next to me, shooting and directing fire. The SEAL just behind him unloaded two full 100-round belts through his machine gun, spewing spent shell casings across the rooftop that bounced with a metallic clink. Everybody was shooting, having a hell of a time. There was much laughter as guys unloaded what was clearly a ridiculous amount of gunfire at the enemy. Soon, the enemy fighters were either dead or retreating, and their attack subsided. The SEAL machine gunner looked around with a smile. "This is my third deployment to Iraq," said the SEAL machine gunner excitedly, "and that's the first time I've ever fired my machine gun in combat." It was his first day on the ground in Ramadi. A few of us had been here for a week, including Leif, some of the other key leaders, and me, but most of Task Unit Bruiser's SEALs had arrived only that day. As much fun as we had shooting from the rooftop, this was a wake-up call for everyone in Task Unit Bruiser. This was Ramadi, a total war zone, and the most violent place in Iraq. For those of us who had deployed to Iraq previously, it was a realization that this time would be different and a lot more dangerous. Welcome to Ramadi. Throughout 2005 and 2006, the vast and volatile Al-Anbar province was the most dangerous place in Iraq, accounting for the majority of U.S. casualties in Operation Iraqi Freedom. Of all the places in Anbar, the city of Ramadi was the most deadly. Located on the Euphrates River, Ramadi, with 400,000 residents, was the capital of Anbar province and the epicenter of the violent Sunni insurgency. The city was strewn with rubble pile buildings, burned out hulks of twisted metal that had once been vehicles, and walls marred by bullet holes. Giant bomb craters from improvised explosive devices, or IEDs, dotted the main roads through town. Thousands of heavily armed Sunni insurgent fighters loyal to Al-Qaeda in Iraq controlled some two-thirds of the geographic area of the city. U.S. forces couldn't even begin to penetrate these areas without sustaining massive casualties. Al-Qaeda in Iraq claimed the city as the capital of their caliphate. Valiant U.S. Army soldiers and Marines ran convoys and patrols along the deadly, heavily IED'd roads. They conducted cordon and search operations into enemy territory and engaged in fierce fighting. Most of the several thousand U.S. troops in Ramadi were located on large, secure bases outside the city itself. But along the main road through the city, a string of isolated U.S. Marine and Army outposts were constantly under attack. The level of determination and sophistication from insurgent fighters in Ramadi was alarming, far beyond what any of us in Task Unit Bruiser had seen on previous deployments. several times a week. Groups of 20 or 30 well-armed enemy fighters launched hellacious attacks on U.S. forces. These were well-coordinated, complex attacks executed simultaneously on multiple U.S. outposts, separated by several kilometers. They were hardcore Mouj. Many enemy attacks followed a similar pattern. Each began with a sudden barrage of accurate, devastating machine gun fire from multiple directions, which hammered the American sentry posts and forced those on guard to take cover. Then, while soldiers or Marines were hunkered down, deadly RPG-7 shoulder-fired rockets were launched in rapid succession, impacting with violent noise and lethal shrapnel. Next, mortars, fired from some distance away, rained down inside the walls of the coalition compound, often impacting with alarming accuracy. All of this was done in an effort to take out the sentries, or force them to keep their heads down long enough so they couldn't return fire, while the enemy launched their final and most devastating weapon, the VBIED suicide bomber, driving a large truck or vehicle filled with several thousand pounds of explosives. If the truck made it past the concrete barriers, past the Marine or Army sentries that would engage them, and inside the compound, the results would be catastrophic. As deadly as the most powerful U.S. Tomahawk missile launched from a Navy warship, or Joint Direct Attack Munition, JDAM, guided bomb, dropped from U.S. aircraft. These enemy attacks were well coordinated and viciously executed. The Sunni jihadi militants were far more capable than those I had previously seen in Iraq 2 years before, and eager to wipe out American outposts, leaving dozens of Marines or soldiers dead and many more wounded. But those fearless Marine and Army sentries held their ground every time and beat the insurgents back. Instead of taking cover to save themselves, the young Marines and soldiers who manned the watchtowers and sentry posts courageously stood fast and returned fire with deadly accurate machine gun fire of their own. Their selfless stands almost always prevented the vehicle-borne IEDs from entering all the way into the compound. The vehicle-borne IED might explode in a massive fireball and concussion, but the enemy could knock it close enough to U.S. forces, protected behind sandbags and concrete barriers. The Marines and soldiers fought off those attacks with such frequency that they almost became commonplace. Just another day in Ramadi. In Task Unit Bruiser, we were confident, and perhaps even a little cocky, but I tried to temper that confidence by instilling a culture within our task unit to never be satisfied. We pushed ourselves harder to continuously improve our performance. I reminded our troops that we couldn't take the enemy for granted, that we could never get complacent. With all that in mind, the boys of Task Unit Bruiser were fired up and eager to prove themselves as we deployed to Ar Ramadi in the spring of 2006. Immediately upon arrival, we were humbled by the violence of the battlefield and the incredible heroism of the conventional U.S. soldiers and Marines of the 2nd Brigade Combat Team, 28th Infantry Division. Our SEALs had the benefit of much more advanced training, and all the finest weapons, lasers, optics, and gadgetry that the enormous Special Operations Command budget could buy. But we were in awe of the soldiers and Marines who manned the outposts in enemy territory, and were daily locked in a deadly struggle against a fierce and determined enemy. When the 1st Armored Division's Ready 1st Brigade Combat Team arrived to replace the 2nd Brigade Combat Team, 28th Infantry Division, a month into our deployment, again we developed a deep respect and admiration for these brothers in arms, and were proud to serve alongside them. Every one of the conventional units we work with had seen extensive combat. All had lost troops and suffered many more wounded. These soldiers and Marines were the real deal. They epitomized the term warrior. The enemy was also strong and incredibly capable. They were deadly and efficient, always watching, analyzing, and looking for weaknesses to exploit. If U.S. forces were to win in Ramadi, I saw right away that all of us, U.S. conventional Army and Marine units, and Special Operation units like our SEALs and Task Unit Bruiser, had to work together to support each other. Unfortunately, there were a small number of U.S. Special Operations units, including some SEALs, who view themselves as a cut above regular U.S. Army soldiers and Marines and would only operate independently. That cockiness produced some conventional Army and Marine commanders who didn't like special operations units. But if U.S. forces were to win this difficult fight here in Ramadi, we would all need to check our egos and work together. From our earliest arrival, we established the precedent that TU Bruja would treat our Army and Marine brothers and sisters in arms with nothing but the highest professional respect and courtesy. SEAL units are sometimes known for long hair and sloppy uniforms, but to conventional units, appearance was a measure of professionalism. In Task Unit Bruiser, I insisted that our uniforms be squared away and our haircuts military regulation. We sought ways to work together with these units in support of one another. The goal was simple: secure and stabilize Ramadi. With this attitude of humility and mutual respect, we forged strong relationships with the Army and Marine battalions and companies that owned the battle space in and around Ramadi. We took great risks to patrol deep into enemy territory, to provide sniper support and protect friendly troops in the streets. Those soldiers and Marines, in turn, constantly put their troops at risk to come help us with heavy fire support. M1A2 Abrams tanks and M2 Bradley fighting vehicles, and casualty evacuations when we needed it. After a month on the ground in Ramadi, Task Unit Bruiser had made a mark. We had figured out how to position ourselves on the high ground, where we could do the most damage to enemy fighters and best support the U.S. Army and Marine units operating in the city. When the enemy rallied to attack, SEAL snipers sprung into action and engaged with precision sniper fire, killing large numbers of well-armed Muj fighters and routing their attacks. As enemy activity escalated, so did SEAL aggression. Once our SEAL elements were discovered, our positions transitioned from clandestine sniper hide sites into fortified fighting positions. SEAL machine gunners joined the fight, hammering enemy fighters with hundreds of rounds from their belt-fed machine guns. Other SEALs lobbed 40-millimeter high-explosive grenades and launched our own shoulder-fired rockets at the enemy. Rapidly, the number of enemy fighters killed at the hands of Task Unit Bruiser SEALs grew to unprecedented levels. Every bad guy killed meant more U.S. soldiers, Marines, and SEALs survived another day. They were one day closer to returning home safely to their families. Every enemy fighter killed also meant another Iraqi soldier, policeman, or government official survived. And more Iraqi civilians lived in a little less fear of Al-Qaeda in Iraq and their insurgent allies. We fought an evil enemy, perhaps as evil as any the U.S. military has faced in its long history. These violent jihadists used torture, rape, and murder as weapons to ruthlessly terrorize, intimidate, and rule over the civilian populace who lived in abject fear. The American public and much of the Western world lived in willful naivete of the barbaric, unspeakable tactics these jihadis employed. It was subhuman savagery. Having witnessed this repeatedly, in our minds and those of the people who suffered under their brutal reign, the Muj deserved no mercy. For our relatively small group of about 36 SEALs, the number of enemy fighters killed on a daily basis drew attention from the upper echelons of our chain of command. As Task Unit Bruiser continued to operate with awesome lethality, some other units across Iraq wanted in on the action in Ramadi. One particular group of advisors from another part of Iraq had similar capability to our SEALs in Ramadi and worked alongside a well-trained Iraqi Army unit. Unlike most Iraqi soldiers, these troops were equipped with good gear, including some of the best rifles, scopes, lasers, night vision goggles, and body armor in Iraq. With the right training and the right equipment, these Iraqi soldiers' skill level and operational capabilities far exceeded any of the other Iraqi Army units we worked with in Ramadi. Because of their superior training and high level of visibility with U.S. top military brass, this Iraqi unit and their U.S. advisors had a great deal of leeway to operate wherever and however they wanted. When they got wind of the action in Ramadi, they quickly gained approval to move there and get to work. When the new unit arrived, they were sent to Camp Corregidor Forward Operating Base on the eastern side of the city. Camp Corregidor was owned and operated by the U.S. Army 101st Airborne Division's 1st Battalion, 506th Parachute Infantry Regiment, the legendary 506th, made famous by Stephen Ambrose's book Band of Brothers, which became an HBO miniseries. The book followed a single company's heroic efforts in the European campaign against Nazi Germany in World War II. Those brave men had set a high standard, and the modern-day soldiers of the 1st of the 506th carried on that tradition with pride and added to their historic legacy. The 1st of the 506th Battalion was commanded by a U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel, an extremely smart, charismatic, and professional officer who set the standard for military leaders. He was one of the finest battlefield commanders with whom I had the honor to serve. The Colonel commanded with a subtle intensity that was complemented with a genuinely kind and easygoing attitude. He was an incredible leader, and leading men in the violent battle in Ramadi demanded every ounce of leadership possible. Camp Corregidor was combat living defined. Everything was difficult there. A fine, powder-like sand, which U.S. troops called moon dust, caked buildings, equipment, weapons, vehicles, clothing, and skin. But that was the least of the problems. Camp Corregidor bordered on one of the most dangerous areas of Ramadi, called the Malab District. The camp was under constant attack from mortars, machine guns, and rockets. The colonel expected the highest level of discipline from his 1st of the 506 soldiers. He knew that slacking here, even when just going to the chow hall for lunch, could result in horrific wounds and death. Discipline in such a situation started with the little things: high and tight haircuts, a clean shave every day, and uniforms maintained. With that, the more important things fell into place: body armor and helmets worn outdoors at all times, and weapons cleaned and ready for use at a moment's notice. Discipline created vigilance and operational readiness, which translated to high performance and success on the battlefield. We sent Task Unit Bruiser SEALs from Delta Platoon to live and work out of Camp Corregidor to train and combat advise Iraqi soldiers there and support the 1st of the 506th Band of Brothers. When the SEAL element arrived, they humbly took on the same habits as their 1st of the 506th hosts. Despite more relaxed grooming standards SEALs typically enjoy elsewhere, the SEALs at Camp Corregidor cropped their hair short, shaved every day, and even donned the same Army combat uniform camouflage as their Army counterparts. This overt sign of camaraderie endeared the SEALs to the soldiers of the 1st of the 506th. These soldiers had been in a bloody fight for nearly 6 months, and the SEALs treated them with professionalism and respect. The Army returned that respect, and a bond quickly formed between soldiers and SEALs. Our SEALs had been working out of Camp Corregidor for several weeks, carrying out dangerous operations with courage, skill, and effectiveness when the new unit arrived. At first, the SEAL platoon commander at Camp Corregidor was concerned at the arrival of the new, well-trained Iraqi unit and their American advisors. He called me on the field expedient telephone and confided, "This unit that just arrived likely has much better capability than us. They have a lot of experience. Their Iraqi skill level is far above our conventional jundis. They have much better gear and good weapons, and their Iraqis even have a sniper capability." I replied, "That's good. I'm glad there are Iraqi soldiers that have progressed that far. If you show them the ropes and get them familiar with the battle space, they will be a great asset." "I don't know," the SEAL platoon commander replied. "I'm worried these guys will be better than us and take over our mission. Maybe I should just let them figure it out on their own," he said. I quickly realized what was going on. As good as this platoon commander was, his ego was being threatened. In an environment like Ramadi, trying to figure things out for yourself could easily get you killed. This was no place for ego. "No, don't even think about that. Listen, the enemy is outside the wire. I told my SEAL platoon commander bluntly. Our enemies were the insurgents lurking in the city of Ramadi, not other coalition forces inside the wire, on U.S. bases, with us. We had to all work together towards the same goal of defeating the insurgency. We couldn't let ego get in the way. I continued, this new advisor unit, these are Americans and good Iraqis, possibly the best Iraqis. You do whatever you can to help these guys. If they outperform your team and take your mission, good. We'll find you another one. Our mission is to defeat this insurgency. We can't let our egos take precedence over doing what is best to accomplish that. Got it, boss, said the platoon commander. A smart and humble warrior, he quickly recognized his viewpoint was wrong and changed his attitude. It was immaterial which units did what or who conducted the most operations. It was about the mission and how we could best accomplish it and win. The platoon commander and his element of SEALs had been bravely fighting hard. They had been in dozens of firefights in the few weeks they had been at Camp Corregidor and could use all the help they could get from another capable unit. While the SEAL platoon commander quickly put his ego in check, unfortunately, there were other egos getting in the way. As the new unit began to interact with the SEALs and the first of the 506th personnel, some of their attitudes raised eyebrows. A few of them did not carry themselves with the same humility as the band of brothers, first of the 506th soldiers, and our SEALs did on Camp Corregidor. A handful of the troops from the new unit flaunted an undisciplined appearance. Some had mustaches and goatees with long hair. They wore dirty baseball caps and cut-off t-shirts with mismatched uniforms. Now, some military units on remote, isolated bases might ease their grooming standards in order to fit in with the local populace or with the foreign military units they are working with. In some cases, such an appearance might even be required. But here in Ramadi, in close proximity with conventional forces, on bases owned and operated by the Army and Marine Corps, this was bound to cause friction. In the minds of some of the members of this new unit, they were above conforming to the colonel's strict grooming policies. But that alone was an issue that could be overcome. After all, a clean uniform does not a good soldier make. But the problems didn't stop there. Some of the unit's U.S. advisors did not address the first of the 506 soldiers with professionalism and respect. They talked down not only to rank soldiers, but also to senior leaders. Considering virtually every rifleman in the first of the 506 had more combat experience than most of the men in this unit ever would, this was especially shocking. To make matters worse, the new unit made it clear they had little interest in listening to advice or learning from the SEAL platoon commander and his men. After weeks of sustained combat operations in one of the worst sectors of Ramadi, our SEALs had lessons learned that saved lives. From specific gear needed, to how much ammunition to carry, to the amount of water needed for missions, to effective tactics and communications plans, the SEALs had learned a great deal about conducting operations with the 1st of the 506th in this specific area. When they attempted to pass this valuable information on to the new unit, their advice was shunned. Overconfidence was risky in such a hostile environment, a mistake most often made by warriors who had never truly been tested. Because of the thousands of well-armed insurgents and extreme violence that engulfed Ramadi, every U.S. unit had to carefully coordinate plans and be ready to support each other. Here, the constant threat from large-scale enemy attack, with the potential to overwhelm and annihilate a small group of U.S. troops, was very real. That meant everyone had to share operational details of plans as much as they could in order to ensure synchronized efforts. From large, battalion-size operations to simple logistics convoys, it was essential to coordinate and keep other units informed in order to give everyone the greatest chance of survival and prevent fratricide. Yet, when planning their missions, this new unit working in the 1st of the 506th battle space refused to disclose their plans, locations, timelines, or other operational details. They didn't think they needed to inform the colonel of their plans. This meant they intended to go out into the colonel's battle space, among his units, rely on his support when things went sideways, and conduct operations without fully coordinating. When the 1st of the 506th Battalion Operations Officer confronted them and asked for the plan detailing their first mission, the new unit's leader told them, "We'll tell you later, on a need-to-know basis." When the 1st of the 506th Tactical Operations Center, or TOC, inquired about the unit's specific plan location for a mission, a standard practice to prevent friendly units operating in the area from accidentally engaging them, and enabling the 1st of the 506th TOC to send help to their location when needed, the unit's leader provided a 4-digit grid from the military grid reference system. This meant that the unit's troops could be located anywhere within a 1,000-meter grid square, all but worthless to the 1st of the 506th TOC. Earlier, we had learned some tough lessons in information sharing, or lack thereof, that had resulted in fratricide. In such a dangerous operating environment, with large numbers of well-armed enemy fighters and multiple friendly units maneuvering in the same battle space, such a lack of coordination could well mean a death sentence. The SEAL platoon commander soon reported back to me on the friction between the new unit and the 1st of the 506th soldiers. My advice was simple. Give them what they need and try and help them if you can, but it sounds like they will make their own bed. Unfortunately, the platoon commander was not able to help, and the situation did not improve. In less than 2 weeks, the colonel directed the unit to leave Camp Corregidor. With such impressive operational capability, they should have been a big contributor to the fight. But the colonel and his troops simply could not risk working with a group where some members' egos prevented them from ever fully integrating with the 1st of the 506th Battalion. As a result, the unit had to watch the historic Battle of Ramadi from afar as Delta Platoon SEALs and 1st of the 506th soldiers took the fight to the enemy in the Malab, killing scores of insurgents and helping to accomplish the strategic objectives of securing and stabilizing the city. Principle. Ego clouds and disrupts everything. The planning process, the ability to take good advice, and the ability to accept constructive criticism. It can even stifle someone's sense of self-preservation. Often, the most difficult ego to deal with is your own. Everyone has an ego. Ego drives the most successful people in life. In the SEAL teams, in the military, in the business world. They want to win, to be the best. That is good. But when ego clouds our judgment and prevents us from seeing the world as it is, then ego becomes destructive. When personal agendas become more important than the team and the overarching mission success, performance suffers and failure ensues. Many of the disruptive issues that arise within any team can be attributed directly to a problem with ego. Implementing extreme ownership requires checking your ego and operating with a high degree of humility. Admitting mistakes, taking ownership, and developing a plan to overcome challenges are integral to any successful team. Ego can prevent a leader from conducting an honest, realistic assessment of his or her own performance and the performance of the team. In the SEAL teams, we strive to be confident, but not cocky. We take tremendous pride in the history and legacy of our organization. We are confident in our skills and are eager to take on challenging missions that others cannot or aren't willing to execute. But we can never think we are too good to fail or that our enemies are not capable, deadly, and eager to exploit our weaknesses. We must never get complacent. This is where controlling the ego is most important.
Application to business. Leif Babin. "I've got an immediate fire that's causing us a big issue, and I need some help with this," said the voicemail. "Please give me a call as soon as you can." The voicemail was from Gary, a mid-level manager in the operations department of a corporation with which Jocko and I had worked through our company Echelon Front. We developed a 12-month leadership program for the corporation. Every few weeks, we traveled to their corporate headquarters for training with a class of a dozen mid-level managers from various departments. In addition to the classroom sessions, we provided coaching and mentorship to help our course participants apply what they learned in class to their everyday leadership challenges. Jocko and I had spoken to Gary by phone several times over the past few months and helped him solve some minor leadership dilemmas and build a more effective team. He was a hard worker, dedicated to his job and his team, and he was eager to learn. It was rewarding to watch him grow as a leader over the months of our course. As a result, he had much greater confidence in himself to make the decisions that would help his team more effectively execute their mission. Now he had a major issue, a serious leadership challenge that was pressing. I was eager to help. I gave him a call to find out what had happened and what I could do. "How you doing, Gary?" I asked when he picked up the phone. "Not too good," Gary responded. "We just had a major issue on one of our critical projects." "What happened?" I asked. I couldn't hope to match Gary's expertise in this industry, but I could help him solve his leadership challenges, improve communication, and run a more effective team. "Our drilling superintendent made a call on his own to swap out a critical piece of equipment," said Gary. "He totally violated our standard operating procedures. I have told him before how I wanted this done, and he completely blew me off." Gary was angry. Obviously, Gary's ego had been bruised by the fact that the drilling superintendent hadn't cleared the decision through him. "This is something he knew he should have run through me," Gary continued, "and he blatantly did not. He made the wrong call, and that set our completion date back several days, costing our company serious capital. In this industry, each day lost on the project could cost hundreds of thousands of dollars." "Tell me about your superintendent," I said. "Why do you think he would do that?" "No idea," said Gary. "He knows he has to run that call through me. But he's been in this business way longer than I have, and he's got a ton of experience. Sometimes he looks at me, and his face says, 'What the hell do you know?' I'm sure he thinks he knows better than me." "Perhaps he was just pushing the envelope to see what he could get away with," I replied. "Which can escalate if you let it go." "That's part of the problem. I'm worried about how he will respond to my critique," said Gary. "With years of knowledge and experience, he is a critical member of this team. We can't afford to lose him. If I call him out, he is going to blow up at me, and the friction between us is likely to get even worse than it already is. And you know the climate in this industry. With his experience, he can find another job tomorrow if he wants to. That means you will have to check your ego in order to have a constructive discussion with him and get this under control," I responded. "Let's think this through," I continued. "Do you think he deliberately tried to shut down drilling operations and cost the company money?" "No," admitted Gary. "I'm sure he thought he was doing what was best for the immediate situation as it presented itself. At the tactical level, on the front lines where the guys in the field execute the mission," I said, "it is critical that the troops grasp how what they do connects to the bigger picture. Your superintendent may not have really understood how his failure to follow procedure and get approval for these changes would result in hundreds of thousands of dollars lost. Do you think that is possible?" "Definitely. He has exceptional hands-on knowledge of drilling, but he doesn't really deal with the big picture," Gary replied. His anger subsided and his bruised ego diminished as he realized the superintendent had probably not been willfully insubordinate. He now began to understand the reasons the superintendent made the decisions he did. As a leader, it is up to you to explain the bigger picture to him and to all your frontline leaders. "That is a critical component of leadership," I replied. But Gary was still concerned about how to deal with his drilling superintendent and the superintendent's ego. "How can I communicate this to him without ruffling his feathers and getting him all pissed off at me?" asked Gary. "If I confront him about this, our communication will get even worse than it already is." "That is another critical component of leadership," I quickly replied. "Dealing with people's egos, and you can do so by using one of the main principles we taught you during our course, extreme ownership." Gary responded, "Ownership of what? He's the one that screwed this up, not me." It was clear Gary's ego was getting in the way of the solution to this problem. "Ownership of everything," I answered. "This isn't his fault, it's yours. You're in charge, so the fact that he didn't follow procedure is your fault. And you have to believe that, because it's true. When you talk to him, you need to start the conversation like this. 'Our team made a mistake, and it's my fault. It's my fault because I obviously wasn't as clear as I should have been in explaining why we have these procedures in place and how not following them can cost the company hundreds of thousands of dollars. You're an extremely skilled and knowledgeable superintendent. You know more about this business than I ever will. It was up to me to make sure you know the parameters we have to work within and why some decisions have got to be run through me. Now, I need to fix this so it doesn't happen again. Do you think that will work? Asked Gary, sounding unconvinced. I'm confident it will, I replied. If you approached it as he did something wrong, and he needs to fix something, and he is at fault, it becomes a clash of egos, and you two will be at odds. That's human nature. But if you put your own ego in check, meaning you take the blame, that will allow him to actually see the problem without his vision clouded by ego. Then you both can make sure that your team's standard operating procedures, when to communicate, what is and isn't within his decision-making authority, are clearly understood. I wouldn't have thought to take that tact, Gary admitted. It's counterintuitive, I said. It's natural for anyone in a leadership position to blame subordinate leaders and direct reports when something goes wrong. Our egos don't like to take blame, but it's on us as leaders to see where we fail to communicate effectively and help our troops clearly understand what their roles and responsibilities are and how their actions impact the bigger strategic picture. Remember, it's not about you, I continued. It's not about the drilling superintendent. It's about the mission and how best to accomplish it. With that attitude exemplified in you and your key leaders, your team will dominate.